So we're going to go ahead and start so you don't lose any time for interaction. We're so pleased to welcome you to our last morning of Sunstone. Thank you for attending our opening session 317, titled Trial of Our Faith on Navigating a Faith Crisis. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our recent tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all the paths are given space to be better understood. What this means is we all get to practice feeling challenged. At this conference, you might hear things that you agree with, things that inspire you, and things that help you grow. Growth can be experienced in many ways. As you go through the conference and encounter ideas all over the spectrum of belief, we invite you to employ empathy as your standard of engagement. We are so very pleased you've decided to join us at this conference. We hope you enjoy this session and the sessions to come. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your programs, this presentation description is as follows. Many LDS members are experiencing tension in their relationship with the LDS Church, similar to the tension people in couples therapy have. The best solutions to such tensions aren't in having a satisfying answer to each unique concern, but in understanding the tension itself. Daniel Rollo is studying religious anthropology at UVU and joined the Utah Valley Interfaith Association in 2015. He currently resides in Provo, Utah, as a less active, non-literal Mormon, called as one of his ward's Sunday school teachers. And Daniel, take it from here.
Okay, thank you so much, Corey. So, today, as you've already seen and been introduced, the idea today is about a faith crisis, which I'm sure all of you are fairly familiar with the idea of, but I want to delve into a little bit with what that means and how to navigate that in a healthy way, hopefully like a couples therapy, which couples therapy doesn't always end up with people together or in the same way, but it ends up usually better. So this is the idea. And then I was also hoping, because there's such a small audience, if I could get a little bit of engagement, I just want to know if you or someone you know are or have gone through a faith crisis. And so I just wrote these down, but it's if you've not gone through it, you could say, oh, not yet. Or you're going through it right now, or someone else is going through it right now, or you've already gone through a faith crisis. So if I could get a little bit of participation, this won't be in the recording, but I'll repeat it. So for you, yeah. Okay, having gone through it.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Going through it,
okay. Someone you know. Okay. Got it. Okay. Someone you know? Okay. Got it. Been through it? Someone you know? Been through it? Going through it. And many people you know. Okay. Going through it? Someone that you know. Okay. So also for the idea of saying not yet, hopefully that's not too presumptuous of me. Okay, so trials of our faith on navigating a faith crisis. I just wanted to give a little bit of an outline as to what we'll discuss. So first, I'm just going to discuss my story and kind of where I'm coming from in my experience. And then we're going to get to the idea that helped me overcome that obstacle, sort of that harrowing of a faith crisis, which was a lot of research, basically, that we're going to get into. Then we'll discuss the idea of a faith crisis, what a faith crisis is, in more in depth, as I'd previously mentioned, as well as common LDS trials of faith, concerns that come up pretty frequently, as well as the idea of belief itself, why we believe what we do, which I think a lot of people skip over when they're going through a faith crisis. And then the idea of social interaction when you have family members or ward members who are LDS, how do you interact with them efficiently and not always get in arguments? And then helping other people, which hopefully I can do today in some respects, but ways that we can help others. And then hopefully by the end we'll have time for a Q&A or what have you. So a little bit about my story. When I was young, so my mother is here, which is nice of her to participate in this. So when I was young, my mother was a convert to the LDS Church, and the only person in her family who's LDS. My father, generations have it, you know, inside of the church. So I grew up with someone experiencing the LDS Church for the first time and for the millionth time of, you know, going to Sunday and what that was like. So I had a lot of, I don't know, it was in a way, I was so in it to win it. I loved it so much that I was always talking about the scriptures and spiritual things. And, you know, my mother mentioned that she felt like, well, someone's got to raise the prophet. So, I mean, it may as well be me, she says. So, I mean, you know, there was potential there. I may have missed the boat on that. But then as I got older, this line here is the amount of belief that I have during these experiences. So, you know, I shot up, just skyrocketed there. And you know, really, like I said, I lived it. I loved it. And as a missionary, I had a lot of interesting experiences where a lot of things were confirmed for me about what I previously believed, but also some of the things were challenges. Like when reading scripture study was always my favorite thing. And I would read in the morning, read about the scriptures, read what I was doing, and then I would talk to my companion about it, who was, you know, dozing off lazily during companion study. Anyone who knows a missionary or was one knows what that's like. So I would bring up things to them, and I'd say, oh, I read this in the scriptures. There was this and this. And they say, no, that's not true. That can't be, right? And if someone almost physically got in a fight with me because I mentioned the idea that scriptures seem to allude to the idea that we're not literal children of God, that we're spirits that existed beforehand, so we're like adopted at most. And he got really upset physically. I realized a lot of things about what people believed and how I was looking at the church in a way that a lot of people don't look at the church, in a way that you're able to question things. So I still had this sort of, I was looking under the hood of my religion, and I realized that there was a lot of, unlike my growing up where there was this personal experience, there was sort of a corporate experience, because I mean, I was a representative, I was like a salesperson, and that was kind of disheartening. And going kind of this dip after my mission, I had a lot of questions and concerns, and then I started dating someone who their family was very LDS and required that the person they date is very LDS. So, I tried a lot. I knew everything. I read the scriptures all the time. I'd be the reason they got to church, but that's not enough because they knew me before we were dating, and so they would talk to their parents, so they knew that I had some questions, and not good enough for their daughter. So with my story, I ended up studying a lot, and I tried learning more, digging in, trying to get this personal experience, although a lot of it ended up being things that I felt I could experience outside of the church. And so as a result, I sort of felt like I needed to get some distance. I needed to go on sort of an away for myself. So this is my story. If this helps a little bit, and then during this time even, I was still, you know, I'd check in at church every once in a while, and you know, there's strong ties there, emotional, cultural. So the main idea for what I did as a result was I wanted to see. Basically, I'm traveling and trying to understand what's going on, and I really didn't know where to go during this experience. And there were two major problems that I saw. One was that people ended up walking through blindly, kind of stumbling through the experience itself, and they would say they don't know what's happening or where they're going or what. It's a lot to sift through. And there's a Joseph Campbell quote that we'll review later that kind of gets to the heart of what I felt during that. Joseph Campbell is my hero, personal hero. So a lot of people were going through it blindly without knowing what other people had done to go through it. And then also the second is a lot of visceral parts of myself, everything, again, I thought I might be the prophet someday. I was so invested and interested in this religion that all of my identity circled around it. And it was painful to try to pick these out and see which parts were me and which weren't me and trying to understand all of that. So I wanted to avoid these two concerns and these two issues that I'd already started during my journey. And the main way that I wanted to do that was just go through it with my eyes open. I wanted to understand what other people have done to get through this. So this gets to the idea of the research. So I started researching, I started learning, and really, I just realized I need a map. I need to understand where other people have been, how they've navigated it, and then how I can navigate it as well. And I'm a researcher by heart, by everything about me is I'm interested in researching, and I do that all the time. And so this was sort of a natural jump for me. And what I realized was there was this disconnect between the disbelieving and believing aspects of what I would encounter. And most people, I just assumed that most people would either fall in one or the other camp, and it would be a lot of this dichotomy that would be presented. But as a lot of you are aware, that you know, it's a lot of this sort of gradient that exists. And there's a nuance that can be experienced in the LDS Church that I was able to take part in because of some of the things that other people were able to say. So that really helped me kind of define that map. So with the contributors, I was wondering, how have others found footing in their situation? And, you know, everyone deserves a voice, I felt. This was going into it, I thought, every side, whether it's really believing or really disbelieving, deserves a voice for me to understand where to go. And because I never know where I'm going to find myself in the future, I realized. If my beliefs had changed in some way at one point, then they could change in the future as well. So I was trying to be open to that possibility, but finding footing is basically what it is, because a lot of it is not finding something that's certain, 100% concrete. If you're going through a faith crisis, or after you've gone through it, it's a lot of finding footing. And we'll discuss that later, but there were a lot of sources just to hit these personal conversations, interviews, blog posts, even comment sections of YouTube videos or an article that I would read, and books, magazines, videos, websites, and more. And some of the people that I'd interview are, you know, religious studies, the same sort of field that I was interested in at both BYU and UVU. So there were a lot of contributors to this. And so I just wanted to define a couple terms really quickly. So these are things that you might hear every once in a while. So if you jot this down, if you're taking notes, these are things, this is what they mean. So a faith transition is the first part. So all of us are currently defining our state with our religious beliefs, right? So this is a constant evolution, our beliefs are. And a faith transition is just the ability to look back and say, oh yeah, last year I used to think this, now I think this. There's a difference in what you believe now. And, you know, it's sometimes this sort of season where some things are more important to you than other times. But also redefining your relationships, including people in the church, with the church itself, with God. And it's an adjustment. You know, it takes, it's the difference between a season, basically. And it's slow, but you experience that. And then a faith crisis, which is what we're here to talk about today, is more intense. Obviously, it's a tsunami, which implies the sort of drastic change that takes place here. So this is not, as opposed to seasons changing, and yeah, you have some weather here and there, this is like a torrent of rain that you experience with that transition and what that feels like. So there's a lot of doubt and conflict that comes up here, and even more adjustment. These are a lot of growing pains because you're a lot of change and you have to adjust to that. And then lastly, disenchantment, which the idea here is that, you know, taking something off of its pedestal, it feels like something has been torn from a pedestal that was previously so significant or true or good, and now it's in question. And, it, you know, it's disappointing. It's a disappointment in that. And it's feeling that something isn't as good or true as we believed it was. Some people call this disillusionment, but these are the main terms that are helpful to understand. The faith transition, faith crisis, and disenchantment. So there's some differences there. Basically, this is a more intense version of that, and this is the result of the faith crisis. So with the faith crisis, asking how it occurs, as previously mentioned, it's about something being big and immediate, right? So not this tortoise. We're not going to deal with that, right? It's just this. This is the hare. This is the experience that we're having where it's really fast. It's a jolt. It's a big difference where something is happening. And there's actually two ways that we can experience that. One, and the reason there's these two, if it changes slowly over time, then that's just a faith transition, not a faith crisis. Both take time to heal or evolve with and grow with. But these two are the ones that we experience as a quick experience. So one of them is the last straw, where people talk about the proverbial shelf that they put their questions on, or, you know, I always looked at Brigham Young's quote about that, like a puzzle, right? And then so he picks it up, looks at it, wonders how it fits in somewhere, and then if it doesn't know, he just puts it on the shelf. So in this case, with the last straw, the idea is that you had things on the shelf over time more and more, but eventually it felt like one thing sort of tipped the rest of it. And then the other is this idea of something happening all at once. So it's just a flash, an occurrence where it's actually pretty rare from all the things that I was able to research where it happens this way. Almost all of them are like this. But the all at once idea is you have exposure to something and you think, oh, what is this? Why am I thinking this? What's this about? And then when you're thinking about it, pondering or researching, looking into it, then just that's it. That was the one thing that sort of really started everything instead of ending it. So that's what a faith crisis is. That's how it happens as far as the way in which it happens time frame wise. But then the faith crisis, which by the way, as far as time frames are concerned, can be a very long time. That depends on the person. But the faith crisis itself, understanding what the results of it are really helpful for especially everyone here who's here for other people going through their own, going through a faith crisis that they can help them with. So there's really four things here. So the first one is really taking your faith seriously, and not just what it means to have faith, but the idea of the validity of your faith. So this is when you're really pouring consideration into the idea, what if this isn't really the way it seems? Or, you know, that consideration that brings that out, taking that seriously is what this ends up being, which a lot of people would say contrary, and they'll say, okay, well, you're just not believing enough, you're not going to church enough or reading your scriptures. But most often, almost always, it's actually this. People are taking their faith very seriously and wondering about the validity of it. So the other second of the four is the unmet expectations. And this can come in pretty much anything. And I'll give some examples of this, but these are the questions that you can ask. So the first one is, what is it that I was expecting? And a lot of people will say, okay, well, I was expecting truth, or I was expecting the church to be the arbiter of truth or the origin of truth or anything like that. So I was expecting that, or inclusion, or the things that I felt I was told to do, I felt the church should do with things like inclusion. Anything that you were expecting from the church or the people or the leaders or the doctrine or history, we had an expectation that was unmet. And then you can ask yourself, from whom was I expecting this? Most people intuitively understand that question, but just making sure you're asking it. And then also asking if your expectation is realistic is something that hardly anyone does, apparently. So a few people mentioned this. I mean, obviously everyone does this to a degree, but really asking the question, is expecting, like for me, is expecting the church that I was raised in to be the arbiter of truth where all good can come and will come from, is that a realistic expectation? For me, I felt like it wasn't. And so now with, you know, what I'm expecting, I don't expect the LDS church for me to give me all truth. So this is back to kind of my story. I'm not now expecting that. And as a result, I feel like my expectations are a little more realistic. My relationship with the LDS church is a lot better. This is where the couples therapy comes in. So with the faith crisis, we know what a faith crisis is, kind of how it occurs as far as the way and time, but then also what causes it is a big question, because we're going to talk about what happens before and then what are the results of it. So what causes it? This is what I call our hierarchy of beliefs. Everyone has a little list like this. This is a nice list. So these are beliefs that someone would hold, and we're going to suggest that these are beliefs from the LDS church. And you can see that sometimes you can even see that prophets, when they've discussed things, or general authorities, you can see that they value some things over other things. And it becomes obvious by the frequency and the intensity that they discuss that topic. But with person A, they'll say, okay, A, B, D, C. Yeah, these are the things. Number one most important thing is A for me in the church. And then over here, you can see this person, number three thing is A, right? And then B is more important than A for them. The one thing that these people could agree on is that A and B are more important than D. That's about where the conversation can kind of end there, because everyone has this, prophets, general authorities, stake leaders, as well as bishops, you, your spouse or family, or the friends that you're here to help. They have things that they value over other things. So in a way, I like to say that everyone is a religion unto themselves. The person sitting next to you in the pew might have a different belief about how involved or how judging or how concerned or any of that God is with us. If we can consider that the person sitting next to us might have less in common with us than the person at a Pentecostal church randomly selected, there's no way to really know what the person's values are. They just happen to be in the same church building as us. So that's actually something that's really helpful. That was helpful for me to understand during my own faith crisis. So the first part of the hierarchy of belief is asking, how much do I believe this thing is true? And another question for it, you know, how much did I bet on it? Meaning, how many hours have I spent doing this? How much have I spent in tithing? Or, you know, what are the things that I've sacrificed? You know, have I given up a scholarship to go on a mission? or anything like that. Like, what did you bet on this thing? That really gives weight to it. But also, how much you believe it, if it outweighs the other things, obviously this is going to be a bigger issue because that's the concern that you have that weighs more than all the others. The first person, you know, D or C was at the bottom. So, yeah, everyone kind of goes through, oh, yeah, I don't know about that, or, but they can dismiss that because it's not as significant to them as other parts of the church or other doctrines. And then the second part is about asking how foundational the belief is. This is foundational to two things. One is the other doctrines that are built upon it. Like someone might suggest, okay, you know, the virgin birth for me was never very significant, but someone else might have so much weighing on the virgin birth with their other beliefs that they feel are built upon it, that when you take out this bottom card, the rest of them suffer as a result. So the other thing it could be built on is your identity. And you could ask, you know, who am I without this belief? And that's a difficult question to answer. But these are the things from the hierarchy of belief. How important is it? How foundational is it that we can understand better where someone is coming from? If they're having a faith crisis, they have something that they believed a lot and often is very foundational to other beliefs. That's where the struggle is. So in understanding, especially helping other people, but understanding in yourself what your own hierarchy is very productive because we all have doubts. And what matters is kind of how we deal with those doubts. Beyond this point, because this is, I mean, it's going to be a tough road for anyone going through this. That just kind of comes with the territory, but dealing with it in a productive way can be one of the more authentic experiences someone can have, even though it's going through a lot of the briars to get to said result. So now we know what led up to it, right? How important is it? How foundational is it? And now we know what the definition is of a faith crisis. So here's what it feels like if you're going through it or if you're experiencing it. So the first one is the idea that you're feeling lost, right? A lot of your questioning identities, situations come up with this idea, or you feel like you're off the beaten path, and therefore, I don't know, does anyone here like to hike around here? Raise of hands. Yeah? A lot of people. So if you've ever gone off of a trail that's clearly defined, then you'll know that if you're off the beaten path, there's bushes, there's thorns, there's trees, there's a lot of ducking and weaving that you have to figure out that's not curated for you. And it's a lot of piecing things together of what you believe and who you are. And then I also wrote this down here, but it says, members will say that this is evidence that you should not leave the LDS Church. This is the result of leaving, and this is what's happening. But oftentimes what people who've already gone through it, and if, you know, anyone who's gone through it in here, tell me if I'm right about this, but it says the painful and harrowing process is what eventually leads to an authentic life. If anyone in here who's gone through a faith crisis, if that's true, just give me an amen. Amen? Amen. Okay, I've got some amens. We need to turn that volume up on you guys, but that's fine. So the next part is the idea of feeling unworthy or worthless. You feel like you're less than believers. You feel like you're less than your previous self because you used to believe that and used to maybe even be a perfect specimen of Mormonism, right? Future prophet. Guilty as charged. And then we question what we once praised. And that becomes difficult because it feels like a hypocrisy inside of us that's difficult to deal with. We feel alone in this. And also we kind of feel like there's the possibility that maybe that information was pearls before swine. We being the swines. Swine? Swine is plural. So the next aspect is feeling ashamed, right? So we feel ashamed because we feel, or we probably even told our friends or, you know, maybe taught classes about it at church or anything like that about doubt being destructive in some way. And then now we are experiencing that. Again, that kind of goes back to the hypocrisy. So these ideas here are basically that they overlap with the unworthy or worthlessness feeling, but we feel ashamed as a result of those things as well. Then there's an uncertainty. At one point we say, okay, I know. So this is how it looks from the time you're 5. I know the church is true, and I love my dad and mom, and I say these things in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. So we knew the church was true. That's a difficult thing to overcome because we're uncertain. The difference between feeling uncertain and skeptical is that uncertainty, at least the way that I'm presenting it, is about investigating your past experiences. These are taking things up. You knew that the church was true, so what other assumptions do I have that might not be true? This is where, again, the idea of foundational belief comes into play, because you could say, okay, well, I once believed this fervently, and I was adamant about it, and now I have all of these other assumptions that I'm aware of. Now those are called into question. When an unquestionably true thing feels false, or seems to be false, or seems to be less good than you thought, a lot of this uncertainty comes where you retroactively try to understand and reinterpret with reinterpretations of your spiritual experiences or anything like that. And a lot of related questions, again, with the idea of it being foundational, comes up. And then lastly, with this section, feeling skeptical. This is, you question everything. Someone says, so I'm here from this other organization or church or religion, and I just wanted to tell you this one thing. And maybe whereas before we might be a little more open to that possibility, or we all have the same God, or whatever the view of it is, universalistic or pluralistic in your approach, then now you feel like you want to question that. Like, where's the proof? That's the question that you might have, because you feel like maybe you were bamboozled. And a lot of people kind of give this feeling or express that in the research that I was doing. And then we just say, okay, I'm not going to blindly accept anything anymore. I'm just going to be skeptical about everything. And even the methods of finding truth are questioned, like Moroni chapter 10, right? If you pray and you ask for an answer, a lot of people feel like they received a witness for that. But again, reinterpreting some of the things from this uncertain section become difficult, because the organization or the religion or the church that you were part of gave you that method, that gave you that answer, and now that method is in question as well, because it gave you that certain answer that you feel now is untrue or not as good as it once was. And then the question also turns to, who can I trust? So there are a lot of things that go into this as a feeling after enduring this experience. So anyone who's here, who's going through this, can probably relate to a lot of these things. I'm sorry for your pain, and I really hope that these next parts can kind of help alleviate some of that. Okay. So these are the common trials of faith that I've noticed. I tried grouping them in different ways and understanding what are the similarities between these. And really, there's three main ones, right? One is doctrinal, one's personal, one's historical. And for anyone who is or has gone through this, you can identify. Can you identify which one of these is there? If you raise your hand, if you can identify it. Okay, I'm getting nods, but okay. So the idea here is, We'll focus on each one of these, and I'll give you kind of a run through. If you hear the thing that you had an issue with or that someone else has an issue with, then this should add some validity to the fact that these are the things that I saw all the time. So one was Joseph Smith, his character, his person. The other was the idea of folk magic specifically. The first vision and varying accounts, the translation of different texts, especially often the idea of the Book of Abraham come up here, but translation and, the seer stone, things like that. The Book of Mormon itself, with the historicity of it, the witnesses and what they ended up like or saying, and the polygamy and polyandry is one that gets brought up often. the martyrdom of Joseph Smith, you know, the experiences around it, what led to it, and what they were actually happening during the time. The Mountain Meadow Massacre is another, you know, militaristic choices that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young made that cost lives. Being gay or black or female, and the experiences that they've had historically with the church. Distortion of what things seem to be and kind of hiding those things, it might feel like. The idea of excommunication itself is often upsetting to people, and finances, you know, with what the church has done through time and how they've been open about that. So historical issues, there's a lot of things there. There's a lot with all of these, but the next we're going to focus on is the doctrinal aspect. And these ones also, this has a lot because it also covers theology and doctrine. But the main things here are, right, leadership fallibility, things in the past that maybe were believed or taught, like blood atonement, especially advocated by Brigham Young, or Adam God theory, the idea of the church maybe being unscriptural. If you're looking at the Bible and you say, okay, it seems like the Bible's suggesting this, but the church is doing this. So depending on where you're putting your weight, doctrinally, it could not match up. Difficult scripture passages. Don't really have an example. I guess, like, Alma, when he was visiting some people. Man, I've got to brush up on my Book of Mormon, apparently. But Alma was visiting, and he was a missionary, and then people were throwing the people into the fire, and then he says, okay, well, don't stop them, right? Because the person that he's with, his mission companion, tries to go to stop him. He says, well, hang back. God wants this to happen so that the people doing it can be judged harsher in the afterlife. And I'm like, oh, I don't like that. So the idea of a true church or a one true church is also a doctrinal question for a lot of people. The monopoly on truth, where feeling other people don't have truth, or organized religion in general, often, again, very foundational to a lot of these other things, or God and gods and the belief in them or what they're like. The idea of morality and what is or isn't considered moral and what's espoused by the church. And then also, the final judgment actually is almost always what the doctrinal issue is, because you'll have someone who says, I believe that we're not judged for that, or I believe that we are not judged as harsh as we're saying. A lot of doctrinal beliefs actually end up being directly tied to the final judgment and compared to what the LDS Church teaches, compared to what I believe about the final judgment. And the last one is the idea of, well, last two, the idea of having vast beliefs. The amount of beliefs inside of the church makes it feel less consistent, makes it feel less certain. And then the idea of science compared with some of the doctrinal claims, especially historical claims, you know, people on the sun or moon or anything like that, or evolution or anything. So that's the doctrinal aspects. And then the personal aspects, don't worry, we're going to take an intermission in just a second, which is really just like stand up for a sec. The personal aspects of this end up being personal, spiritual, cultural type experiences. So the ideas here would be, you know, feeling like you don't fit in, the idea of the Mormon mold, that you might feel like you don't match, or the church isn't looking for someone like you, your ward or stake issues with, you know, people or concerns or, you know, politics there, or the bishop relay where, or roulette, I'm going to say roulette. So that idea that a bishop might be great or horrible at dealing with your experience in how you, again, expect them to. What's your expectation of how they should handle that? Basically, you're saying, if I was a bishop, I would do this. They're not doing that. That's an issue. So socio-political stances, things like Proposition 8, or mostly politics and politics over the pulpit, things like that. anti-intellectualism, feeling like a lot of things are not able to, you're not allowed to ask questions, feeling like you are told not to, or if you pray and get a different answer, then you got the wrong answer, so shake the ball, try again, right? And then the lack of a witness, feeling like you didn't receive a witness when you asked, again, back to Moroni 10. Also, counter-inspiration, which is more rare, but it came up actually a handful of times where people would pray and feel like the church is saying this, but I got this personal revelation that suggests otherwise, suggests this other way of thinking, or where I should be headed, or what people should do. And then feeling maybe confined as well in the LDS church. So there are a lot of, there are a lot packed into these three groups. So I did my best to make sure that it was as few as possible, but this really seems to be what's happening here. So you've got doctrinal, personal, or historical concerns. And so a faith crisis, just in summary, so that we can just breathe for a second. So it's this tsunami of doubt that you experience. It's something unlike a seasonal change. It's just a torrent of rain. It's a harrowing, difficult experience. And you start taking your faith seriously, which created conflict with either doctrinal, personal, or historical aspects of the church. It weighs more than the other things, and it's foundational to other beliefs. So it's more important and it's more foundational from those three areas is where they most commonly come from. And it occurs quickly, which could either be all at once, which again is more rare, or like the straw on the camel's back that broke the camel's back. And then it results in feeling lost, undervalued or worthless, ashamed, also uncertain of reevaluating the things we've experienced or thought, as well as skeptical. So hopefully this is a good way to tie all of this together. And then here's just a quote for just a second so we can stand up and then sit back down just after. So this says, we cannot avoid suffering, but we can choose how to cope with it, find meaning in it, and move forward, which again is this next chapter of this. So this is from Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. If you haven't read that, then you should probably do that. So, all right, so if you'd so choose, you can stand up for just a second, and then I'll resume in maybe 30 seconds. Okay. Hopefully you got your wiggles out. Sunbeams, go ahead and sit down. Okay. So I'm just kidding. You can stand up if you want, actually. So the trials of our faith. So this is basically when I started amassing all this information, I wanted to show you an example of what it looked like to eliminate the bias in all of these things. Because again, like I showed before, there was this disbelieving and believing paradigm and spectrum, this gradient that a lot of these things could be found on. So, I mean, I chose something. This is the original that I found, and I'm going to read this out. But this has a lot of very poignant direct attacks at the LDS Church and people who want to stay in the church. So this is how I edit something like this. So it says, to encourage people to continue the mental gymnastics to stay in an active member, as an active member, is likely encouraging an ostrich, misspelled, this is from a comment section, don't worry, is like encouraging an ostrich to keep its head in the sand. Having a website to encourage people to stay active is in and of itself crazy. One shouldn't need support to be a believer in anything. When challenges arise, answers should be readily available without having to use any double speak or dodge direct questions. To thine own heart be true. Anything less is perpetuating a lie. So this is how I would go about editing something like this. So here's the edited version. This is something that I included in this doc, and again, this is what I did with every piece that I came in and everything that I touched and brought into this document. So it says, though many will likely, and the word likely is important because it's not always certain like these things, or us is important because it's about the collective idea here. So though many will likely encourage us to move either toward or away from orthodoxy, whichever they believe is best, which is helpful to know that they have good intentions, right? We should, and then all of these yellow are suggestions instead of assertions or accusations. So we should stay open to suggestions, right? Similar, and not bury our heads in the sand. We'll justify any action we choose. Good point. Didn't see that over there. I must have thought of that. But try to avoid what some call mental gymnastics, which I added a definition, straining to force a solution. The truth is likely complicated. We have the right to believe whatever we choose, but watch for times we start doing mental gymnastics or dodge a question or questions to maintain faulty views through strain or evasion. So this is what this looks like. This is the editing process for me, and I did this through, so it's a size 8-point font, and at this point it's over 30 pages of just this. This is where I got all of this information from. So understanding this, how we believe, this is understanding belief itself. And I'll make this pretty quick. But the idea here is there are two ways. And again, understanding belief is important because a lot of people skip over this part and they just go to the faith crisis part and understanding a faith crisis if they can. Understanding belief is important because we'll know where we came from and how to get where we want, if that's the case, or how to help other people. Socially, this is very important. So we have an original belief or assumption. After you're exposed to an alternative belief, your belief will never be the same, ever. So there's initial exposure here, and then this is the first idea here, which is maintenance. One is maintenance and one is modification. The only difference is that maintenance is a slightly smaller difference. You thought of something else to clarify your belief, or you thought of it, but you put that on the back burner, okay? So you have exposure, you're intolerant of it, you decide, I don't want to hear this anymore, I don't want to be exposed to this, and then you have isolation where you choose only the things that support what you do currently believe. Everyone who's on Facebook knows that this is where a lot of people are. And then belief or assumption is the output. It's no longer the original belief or assumption, but it's maintained. It's only slightly different, barely noticeable as to a difference there. And then with the modification, with changing our beliefs, we have an exposure, right? And then instead of intolerance, we choose to be tolerant of it. We accept that I'll be around this. I'll listen to this. Just listening. That's it. Then considering and understanding that belief, where you say, yeah, you know what, I kind of like this. And what you do at this point with this star, consideration and understanding, is breaking apart the entirety of it into each of its parts and saying, okay, I like this part, don't like this part. Again, it's making your hierarchy and then choosing which things you think are most important. This partial acceptance is basically things that are contradicting to, they're too dissimilar to your current view. They go back and they kind of repeat this process for an indefinite amount of time. Well, as indefinite as your reality is. So, I got way metaphysical, sorry. So, the particular acceptance is basically, we break it apart, and the things that are paralleling, eventually, at some point, we act on that, and then it becomes a belief or assumption that we will have from there on, and it'll go back to there, where we'll be exposed to other ideas and views. So, this is in its entirety. Has the potential to do all of these things. And then after it's here or here, it will continue to do this. So the context for doubt here, trying to make sure I have enough time for this. So the statistics here, okay. This is in 2009. This is before a lot of things. This is before, so this is, these are the highest statistics that are somewhat recent that you're going to find with how percentage-wise, how many LDS members believe these things. It's before the ordained women movement. It's before the policy change. Just after, just after the Proposition 8. So anyway, this is what it says, right? Families can be bound together eternally in temple ceremonies, right? 95% of people in the LDS Church believe that. President of the LDS Church is a prophet of God, and God the Father and Jesus Christ are separate physical beings. 94% of people. That's a lot of people. You have to get 25 people to find one of these people that would agree with you if you don't agree with this. The Book of Mormon was written by ancient prophets. Oh, only 91%. We got to work on sustaining the faith there. So the idea here is there's a lot of people in the church that are like this. This is the highest statistic, again, that you're going to find. But also, in the United States, this is the average. This is the percentage that you would get if you compared it to everyone in the United States. So it's difficult here because it feels like it's that 95%. You're not going to find someone who doesn't believe it. And if they don't believe it, they're probably not going to bring it up. Or if they do, they're going to be rude about it. So that's what it feels like. But the reality is, in the United States itself, there are pretty low percentages about who might agree with that. So keep in mind that you'd have to find at least, I don't know, too many people. You'd have to find out of 100 people, you might find two people that think that. So that's a lot of people. So then the question is, now what, right? So, and the idea with the last statistics are, you know, you're not alone in a concern or an issue or disbelief in something. The majority of the United States, the majority of the world don't believe that thing. There's a bigger connection that we have with the internet now that can make that apparent. So hopefully that's a resource for you. So it's complicated when we're in this experience, and there's no perfect fit. Again, it's about finding your footing. It's trying to find one place to stand for just a moment until you can find a better footing and continuing in that. And I think one of the big things is a lot of people get in this rear view mirror perspective where they think they need to maintain, back to the maintenance of belief. They feel like they need to go back to how they used to believe. They need to go back to what once was with their belief. But again, with a modification of a belief, you will never believe in the same way. If you do believe the same thing, it will be in a different way. So don't idolize your past self for those things, because that's not going to be possible for you to be in the exact same place again. So the idea here is brought up by the Sunstone, Why We Stay, but it's the idea, you know, not to leave and not to stay, but to redefine Mormonism itself for what it means for you. So my biggest suggestion is take it slow. It's like a hot, steaming hot beverage. It's a hot drink, and I'm going to say it's not coffee or tea, but it's just so hot. It's soup. It's soup in a little teapot, can, cup. Take sips from Mormonism because it's hot. It's difficult to ingest and take in a lot of those things. Taking it slow is the biggest suggestion I could mention for anyone, because a lot of people feel like, I've got to get this together. I've got to figure this out. It's got to happen right now. And I know that this is going to happen. And I'm, you know, teaching Sunday school on Sunday. And how am I going to do this? Because I'm doing this and this. And I'm thinking this. And I don't know if this is going to work out. Then it's like, okay, well, you have years. You have years to perfect your position. And again, every faith transition, you'll just be able to look back and see that you believed something or acted in a different way. You've got a lot of time, even though it feels like you don't, you have a lot of time. So just take sips from Mormonism, and this is the biggest key. Keep what works and leave what doesn't work. These are the things people call like cafeteria Mormons. So yeah, be that. actually. If you want anything to work with the church, you're going to have to do that. And again, everyone has a hierarchy of beliefs. Your bishop, I learned through a couple of bishops that I interviewed for this project that they didn't care at all about a few things that are very important, like on temple recommend interviews. But they have to ask those things, and for them, that's not something that they felt was important. So your hierarchy of belief, understanding that is important. So my biggest suggestion here is treat Mormonism like a foreign religion. A lot of times we think, okay, well, it's my faith, my family, my culture, and who I am, and my identity, and all these things, and it's about me and my, and all these things. What would you say to a friend who was in a different religion if they were going through the experience that you were going through? What would you tell, if you're LDS and you have a friend going through it, what would you tell them if it was a different religion and not the one that you were a part of? This is one of the biggest helps for a lot of people that I've been able to talk and share this document with, is understanding that if you treat it like a foreign religion, not your identity, who you are, all these things, everything will be a lot more smooth. So the question could be, why would you try to stay? And I think that a lot of times people who act hastily, which is why you should slow down, it's cool. Just take a hot drink sip. They're running towards certainty because they want something that's certain, because that's what they've had their whole lives and it's comfortable. And they're kind of running from nuance. I'm not saying everyone should end up in the LDS church the same way that they were, especially because, again, your beliefs change. But also, this nuance is what we're running from, and it's an uncertainty, and it's difficult, but it is very real as to the authenticity found within that experience. So there are a lot of costs of leaving, and you can avoid a lot of those by staying as well. So these are some reasons people stay, and I'm just going to shoot through them, but it's spirituality, community, encouragement to do better, raising children, family and loved ones, some doctrines, again, hierarchy of beliefs, creating change from within and supporting unorthodox members. This is why people stay, and these are things that you could miss out on, some of these, if you leave. So take it slow. You have years to perfect your position. Just take sips. And this is the quote. I'm just going to rattle this off because I have hardly any time. If your private myth happens to coincide with society, you're in good accord with your group. If it isn't, you've got an adventure in the dark forest ahead of you. You've moved out of your society that would have protected you and into the world of fire, an original experience, which has not been interpreted for you. And so you've got to work out your life for yourself. You don't have to go far off the interpreted path to find yourself in very difficult situations. This is what a faith crisis feels like, and this is what is happening. Again, getting off of the beaten path that I said I would come back to. This is the quote, Joseph Campbell. If you don't really... There's a lot of things I guess everyone should read, but I'm not even going to mention anything. So, suggestions. You're not alone, and mostly I'm going to read these titles, but like, your course is valid. You're not alone. There's a lot of people. Again, these came from so many sources that it was insane for me to try to get through them. Sometimes I would stay up just 5 hours just sifting through and editing and finding this information. And, you know, be compassionate with both yourself, other people, and act out of love for people trying to help you if you're going through it. Act out of love if you're trying to help them. It's personal, right? Whatever you choose, it has to come from you if you want to be happy with it. There's no magic formula. There's nothing that's going to work for everyone. That's just how it goes. Even if it's like a medication, which we'll come to, that there is no perfect fit. Some results may vary for each person. Beliefs evolve, right? Don't get stuck saying you think they're going to be the same. The church takes time to change. It's a big institution. It's not just our church, us, me as an individual. And because it will take so long, don't ask permission for pretty much anything. My suggestion here is you're going to need to carve your own place in a ward or in a church. You don't need to be loud about it and, you know, upsetting to people. But in the end, This is how the church can change, become more inclusive, by having a need to be inclusive, by you being there. So, yeah, you're going to fail a lot. Trial and error. It's going to be a lot. Dip your toe in things, see what it's like, and then, again, keep what fits and works, get rid of what doesn't. If at first you don't succeed, right, your first course is rarely valid, so nothing's 100%. Act and don't react, right? Take the wheel. You're in control of a lot of the things in your life right now, even though it feels like you're not. You actually have more control because you're not just following a path. You're choosing where you're trying to go. Treat Mormonism like a foreign religion, like we talked about. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Just don't. There's a lot of good things. Again, there are lots of parts. There's a hierarchy we have, and even if the number one, the number two, number three, four, and five things on our hierarchy are things that we now take issue with, everything below that is still something that we valued and possibly could still value. We need to see, again, you know, what other people are saying. Trust yourself. You're told you can't trust yourself, your thoughts, and your feelings, but you can. It's possible to try logic, for example. Everyone's biased, no matter what you listen to, so just get used to a pinch of salt with everything that people say. The church is like medication, like I mentioned. Side effects might be negative for some, even though it's good for most. Then the false binary view that the church suggests, it's either all true or all false. Just consider that that might not be true as a possibility, or that there's no true church. If there isn't, then what? Because if that's the case, then what would that look like? So there are opinions, not truth, that we find. Unquestioned faith is weak. It's going to be a rough road, like we had talked about. So the main things with interacting with Mormons, as quickly as I can get through these: don't burn your bridges. Set clear boundaries, because you've probably been told in the past you need to openly discuss everything, but that's not necessarily the case. You can discuss what you want with whom you want. Set those boundaries. You're the devil now, by the way. If you talk to someone about your doubts, they see you as the devil. And people who see you saying, okay, I disbelieve this or I have a doubt, they believe that you're the devil and you're tempting them now. So it's kind of hard. Don't try to convince people all the time of your opinion, because this is what their worldview is. Also, peacefully focus on agreeing and where you overlap in this Venn diagram. Wait for them to bite. Put the hook in the water and let them, like, ask questions. Then avoid hypocrisy. If you don't like certainty, absolute certainty, or if you don't like people proselytizing and trying to get other people to believe what they believe, don't be that. Don't do that. That happens a lot. And then these things we don't have time for, but they're so great. And, oh yeah, helping other people. This is the last two slides. So it's the first thing is, it's not, if you're helping someone else, it's not about you. So don't try to use someone else as validation for your own beliefs. Make it about them, because it's about helping someone who feels hurt. And the main things here are: act out of love. Lovingly help them. Listen to their concerns, even when it's difficult. Ask questions instead of telling them what to do or think or believe all the time. And then empathize. Imagine if they were telling you something contrary to your beliefs, like you were about to do to them, to tell them that they're wrong. Imagine what that feels like. Kind of empathize with them. So the summary is basically just everything we've talked about. Taking faith seriously creates a conflict with the doctrinal, personal, historical issues that are more important than other things to you, and it's foundational to your other beliefs. It occurs quickly, either all at once or the straw on the camel's back, and it results in feeling lost, in feeling worthless or unworthy, as well as being ashamed and uncertain of your past experiences, as well as skeptical of future ones. And then what we've just talked about, and since I've been talking so quickly, we don't even need to rediscuss them. So this is the end of this Trials of Faith. Sorry that I had to shoot through so much of it, but this has been really a passionate thing I've been able to take part in and share with a lot of other people. So if you have questions afterwards or want help or direction or you have suggestions for me, I would love to hear it. And I'm just really glad I could be part of this symposium. So I'll give this time over to Corey. Thank you so much.
Thank you.